afternoon. Welcome to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH. We are streaming live on all those smart speakers. Just order it to listen to KTTH and you'll be able to listen to the Jason Rand Show. The anti-Semitic left, they're not even trying at this point to hide their propaganda. It doesn't make any sense. They don't care, but it is what's trending.
What's trending? Anti-Semitism.
Now, we know that NPR is far to the left. Their staff, far to the left. Their take on Israel versus Hamas, far to the left. It is what you would expect. And we say this today as protesters are right outside in New York, the event, the fundraiser for Joe Biden. He's accompanied by Barack Obama, Bill Clinton. They're going to make a ton of money, only to realize that the base of their movement is outside, upset that Joe Biden has taken a position that Israel has the right to exist. And they're going to punish Joe Biden by not voting for him. Now, they're not going to vote for Donald Trump. They might not even vote, or they'll vote for a third party. But they hold positions that you would expect fringe activists to hold. When you hear that on NPR, you kind of do a little bit of a double take. Like, wait, what? Did they really just say that? Did they really just say that? And they're not hiding it. They're not trying to hide it. It's like, it's almost lazy, but it also just indicates that they don't care if you know they're just making stuff up and they're leaning on Hamas propaganda. Now, they did a story on Morning Edition, and it featured an anti-Israel journalist by the name of Jane Arraf. Don't know who she is. I went to her Twitter account. It's very clearly someone who doesn't like Israel all that much. And the conversation is about what we've pretty much all that we've been hearing, which is starvation that's been going on for months and months and months and months, even years, because, you know, Jews have been doing this forever. They're not showing us the proof of that, but just constant starvation. Despite the videos coming from inside Gaza of markets that are selling chicken and canned goods, videos of livestock going into Gaza, TikTok videos of people complaining about some of the food in the airdropped packages coming from the United States. Something tells me that if you were starving, you wouldn't create a video where the lighting is actually pretty good for TikTok, complaining that you got applesauce. I'm just saying. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe when you're starving and you're at mass starvation level, you're just thinking crazy and you just don't like applesauce. But NPR said that the mass hunger is spreading. And it's dangerous for aid to get into Gaza via the airdrop because sometimes, and we saw this early on, or we heard this early on, that some of the packages were literally crushing people and it killed some folks. But then we're hearing that sometimes, you know, it gets a little windy. All of a sudden, the care package goes into the sea. And according to, and this is NPR quoting Gaza authorities, they say Gaza authorities say 12 people just drowned trying to get to the aid packages. Now, Gaza authorities mean Hamas, which they won't say. They also won't call Hamas a terrorist organization. They are a, quote, militant Palestinian group. Oh, okay. Israel, the genociders, Hamas, they're kind of militant. Are they just angry? Are they a terrorist group that doesn't believe in Israel's right to exist and doesn't want to see a living Jew on this planet? It's that one. So this journalist tells you the story, goes through the motions, says everything that they've been saying for the last several months. And it's framed, of course, as Israel is the bad guy. They're not allowing enough aid trucks to go in. They don't necessarily tell you that part of the reason why there's a slowdown on aid trucks going in is because they have to check the trucks for weapons because they've been getting smuggled in via the aid trucks. And yeah, there's actual proof of that, but you don't hear that on NPR. So you've got this main border crossing because they forget that Egypt is on one side, until, of course, it's politically helpful for them. Because apparently the Jews also control the Egyptian border. And I did not realize that about Israel. Did you know that? That they have total and full control over the border between Egypt and Gaza?
They're even more powerful than I thought they were.
Yeah, I mean, this whole time I thought Egypt also didn't like the Jews. But apparently they're all like, hey, if you want to, you can take control of the border. So this is how at least part of the propaganda bit went. Here's just a short clip. And I want you to pay attention to some of the very specific details, and really actually just one very specific detail in this clip.
While the U.S. says those shipments have increased recently to as many as 200 trucks a day.
And by the way, why do they always sound so boring? Like they're bored by their own report. It's like, okay, well,
they're always whispering.
It. Well, that's soothing. We're supposed to protect. I think that when you talk like this, it indicates that you are very smart and thoughtful, also a little bit creepy and probably low energy, but very thoughtful. Good morning. It's Morning Edition.
It's still much less, Layla, than the roughly 500 trucks of aid that aid officials say are desperately needed. A Jordanian official says 30,000 trucks are backed up at the main border crossing with...
Wait. Sorry. Did you edit that?
Nope.
You didn't edit it at all?
Nope. No. Not a bit.
Wait, hold on. Did you put this through AI?
I don't think I know how to do that.
Let's hope you never find out, because, oh my God, you'd screw with me.
30,000 trucks are 30, backed up trucks at the main border crossing with Egypt, waiting for Israeli approval to enter.
30,000 trucks are waiting at the border between Egypt and Gaza. 30,000 aid trucks are waiting. I hope they're not idling, because that's very bad for the environment. They're waiting there. 30,000. Speaking of AI, it actually came in handy today. So I went on AI, ChatGPT, and I said, Mr. ChatGPT, and then got mad at me for gendering him, but I still did it. I said, what's the average size of an aid truck? Came back. It said 70 to 80. There's a trailer attached to it. You've got to have them a little bit large because you're carrying a lot of goods. So I said, okay, that's kind of big. I can't always visualize those, right? I mean, that's just hard to do. You told me like it was 12 football fields. Like, okay, I kind of get that. But even then, I can't really quite get it. But I then said, okay, because I didn't know this. This is the one thing I didn't actually know, which was how many feet in a mile? And the number is actually 2.25 million feet in a mile. It's a lot of feet, right? So then I was all like, well, what's the feet to mile thing then? What is it at the end of it? It's 426 miles long. If we were to calculate all of those trucks, and I assume 75 feet just for the sake of this thought experiment, if we were to line up truck from end to end, just in like a straight line, it would be 426 miles long. Now, I'm going to assume probably then is a fake number that any idiot should have been able to figure out. I know that a quote unquote Jordanian official told you this was happening in Egypt. I got it. Thank you. You don't name the official. Is it another terrorist organization? I don't know. But I then started to get a little bit creative with the ChatGPT because I wanted to figure out what's the best way for me to truly explain how absolutely ludicrous it is for anyone to make this claim. You would have to drive from Seattle to Portland, back to Seattle, back to Portland to get about that many miles in. So just think of it then in these terms. The trucks, back to back to back to back to back, one line to Portland, one line back to Seattle, one line all the way back to Portland. That's how many cars, many trucks, there are apparently waiting at the border of a very, very small piece of land. The Grand Canyon is 277 miles long. Did you know that?
And all this math is hurting my brain, frankly.
That's why I had the AI do it. The Nile River... I won't do that one. But I mean, what? Now, if you truly believe that, let's give the reporter the benefit of the doubt that she's a true believer in her anti-Semitism. If you truly believe that, 30,000 trucks are there, then you really do hate Jews so much that you have, your judgment is that clouded. That's the only way I can think of. Now, did she misspeak? It's still on the website. It doesn't sound like she misspoke. She was reading from a script, so it was put in there. It was typed in there. But then our friend Nicholas Kristof, who is a New York Times columnist, he's based out of Oregon. I think he actually moved back to Oregon when he wanted to run for governor before they were all like, you don't even live here right now. You can't run for governor, idiot. So then he decided to move back. He tweeted this out. And he tagged everyone who was supposed to be tagged. And, you know, he was so proud of what it was that he was doing here. He wanted the world to know what those evil Jews were doing. I mean, think about all the starvation that's going on right now. We could solve all of that if only we would allow even just a portion, just a little tiny portion of the 30,000 trucks that are just sitting there idling away, polluting the environment. Jane Aruff of NPR quotes a Jordanian official as saying that 30,000 aid trucks are stuck at the Egypt-Gaza border waiting for Israeli approval to enter Gaza, with some Jordanian trucks stuck there for the last 2 months. I feel like all the food might have gone bad by then, but okay. Meanwhile, Gaza kids starve. So I looked at some of the responses, and boy, were they calling this dummy out. Like, really, dude? Really, you're going to fall for this? So Nicholas Kristof deleted his tweet, but he did like the stealth delete, doesn't want to call attention to it, because at some point he's all like, man, they're really going to know I'm a true believer in hating Jews. I better just take this down because I don't want to be that obvious. My hatred for Israel clouded my judgment. Let me just take this down. I don't want to be too obvious because then they'll just dismiss me as an anti-Semite. I want them to believe that I'm doing this in good faith. So he just deletes, doesn't put it back up, doesn't say anything, doesn't offer a correction, doesn't offer an apology, doesn't explain why it is he was dumb enough to fall for that to begin with, but that it was published to begin with, that it was then spread by people like Nicholas Kristof, supposed to be a very smart guy. He's a columnist for the New York Times and everything. It tells you that they don't even care to fact check any of this stuff. They don't even care. And so if they're willing to tell you that 30,000 trucks are standing by waiting to go into Gaza, should you trust them when they give you all of these stories about kids are just, they're falling to their deaths of starvation? Some of them can't even get up out of bed. I remember this one kid, according to Gaza officials, he looked up and said, "Mommy, why do these Jews want me to die?" And then he died in her arms. And actually, they were triplets, and all at the same time they died. Yeah. Oh, okay, thanks. Yeah, I definitely believe that one. Cool, thank you. You made me such a better consumer of news. I feel like I really have learned something now. My God, this is NPR, and what bothers me is my tax dollars went to that. But it also does give me a little bit of joy to know that the reporter who hates me got paid because of, in some small part, my tax dollars. So she's being kept employed because of this Jew.
I just hate that people that listen to NPR seem to think they're really smart and better than everyone.
Oh, they love that. It's so pretentious. And they'll have it on in the background. Sometimes when I get into an Uber and they're listening to this, I'm like, well, you're definitely not that smart. Let's be honest here. And they're just like, oh, and I'm listening to just the pretentious nature of all of it. And they cover stories that no one cares about, but they pretend to because they think they come off as more evolved and thoughtful than they actually are. Like, they'll talk about, you know, Siamese twins who are non-binary, who come from war-torn Afghanistan, and they're struggling to survive as they created this new cat cafe that only allows people who really truly love cats. But unfortunately, a dog person came by, killed some of the cats, and now they're really going through adversity. And no one wants to give them a loan to help their business out again because they're non-binary. And by the way, they're going through the first surgery of non-binary twins that are conjoined at the head. That's the story that they do. And it always starts with some stupid little sound effect of like a door opening with a bell on it. Have you noticed that? It's always the same thing. and they just really lean into the live sound from the scenes that really don't even paint a picture that's accurate, but it sounds good. And then you can go back to the office at the water cooler and say, you will never believe what I heard today. You will never believe it. I mean, that their struggle, that's a real struggle. And you know what? I've considered my own white privilege and my own privilege as someone who's not conjoined at the head to a twin. And, you know, it just really got me thinking. Really got me thinking.
I realized I hit a nerve when I brought up NPR listeners.
Ugh. It's not the listeners. It's the people who first put out the garbage content. Because without them, the listeners would only be able to talk about the New Yorker, which, by the way, you don't even read. Okay, you've got a subscription. I got it. You have not gotten through a single New Yorker article. Stop it. Get the little New Yorker on their coffee table. Like, oh, yeah, you're so smart. Oh, yeah, tell me, name one article that's in there. Name an author that even appears in the New Yorker. You read it for the cover with the cartoon that doesn't even make sense and isn't even funny. Center yourself. Push the button.
What's trending on the road?
So you know how we said media likes to take a big story, whether it's local or national, and just try to milk it for everything that it's worth, rather than give us some new information that's actually helpful, that matters, that doesn't in a weird way belittle the big story that you are milking. Well, when you've got a national story, local media have to work overtime to try to localize it. I don't know why they feel the need to do it. They can just give you some local perspectives, I guess. But is it that they know it's going to be covered on the national nightly news, and so they can't completely ignore the story, so they do it? So in this case, you've got the bridge collapse in Baltimore. Horrible story, tragic story, shocking story in every way that inspired every local news station to localize it, because they can't just say this is what happened in Baltimore. And so in this case, we've got Como TV, and they say 213 bridges in Washington state are in poor condition. Now, that certainly seems like a lot. 213? My God. Well, it only represents 2.9% of all bridges in Washington state, just as an FYI. And last time I checked, we don't have a whole lot of giant cargo ships that are going under our bridges. Generally speaking, you know, I don't want to just paint a blanket, picture of the scenarios that could potentially happen on our waterways here in Washington state. And generally, that's the case. So, number one, you're already starting from a very contrived place of, well, could this happen here? Because that's really what the story is. Could this happen here? And it's like, well, I mean, a boat can hit. That's true. And obviously, if it's so fragile, this bridge that's in poor condition that could potentially be hit by a boat, which implies boats actually go near it, I would like it to be fixed. I'm going to assume, just for the sake of argument, despite living in Washington state and being let down so many times, I shall assume that WashDOT will probably address those bridges quickly. That's just a general assumption. But then they'll say, but Jason, don't you remember the bridge collapse a few years ago, Skagit Valley, where no one was hurt? I mean, there was maybe a minor injury. No one died. But it was a serious story. It was a big story. We covered it. And I was like, okay, fair enough. You've got a point. So take us through then the other situations that we need to worry about. So the next time I'm in a car and go over a bridge, I could really, really, really get concerned.
It's a little shocking when I seen it on the news this morning, and it immediately brought me back. It's scary, and are we doing what we need to do to take care of them?
So that's a random resident who lives in Mount Vernon. Again, very close. It was between Burlington and Mount Vernon where the little bridge went out. And I would be in his position, too, if I was reminded of that story. So Como spoke to a guy named Evan Grimm, who has the worst possible last name for someone who looks into the safety of bridges. Grimm? Really? Let's get the Grimm response from WashDOT as to whether or not we have similar risk factors as what was happening with the Baltimore Bridge.
We do have bridges that are steel trusses like that and that are over water and that are in navigable channels. So we do have similar risks to our structures.
Okay. He says we have similar risks. I'm going to say that's probably overstated a little bit based on his chatter there. I mean, yes. Do we have bridges? Yes. Do some of them go into the water? Yes. Do we have boats that go by? Yes. So technically, we are at a similar, you know, threat level of vulnerability, I suppose, as Baltimore. But then he immediately says, still, shut up, relax, it's fine.
The poor bridges in our state are safe to cross. We do close structures anytime there is a safety concern.
Okay. Now, a reasonable concern would be, well, when does a bridge go from poor, which is a bad rating last time I checked, to, oh my God, it's going to collapse, please fix me. And I, of course, don't know the answer to that. But he says, don't worry, we're constantly looking at these bridges. I say, can we maybe change the terms we use? Because if you're telling me the bridge is in poor condition, I'm going to then naturally assume what everybody else would assume, which is it's going to come down the second you even look at it. And if that's not the case, let's maybe not call it poor. Let's call it poor adjacent. Let's call it, okay, it's got some miles driven on it. You know, you can get a little, or give it a nice little score, right? A smiley face to the sad face, and give it one of those, like, I'm a little bit anxious and awkward face. That could be what we're talking about here.
Kind of like on those little, you know, health inspector things outside restaurants.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I want. You know, you can get creative, get a poop emoji for the worst kind. But again, I'm assuming y'all are going to shut that one down before it gets to the level that if I drive over it, it's going to just collapse. Or if a little rowboat hits it, it's going to come down. This didn't offer me anything connected to what happened in Baltimore, nor did it make me feel better about what will happen here in Washington. It just, it doesn't offer anything. And so I wish they would have just avoided really working overtime to get in a local angle for a story that doesn't need a local angle. It's dramatic enough. 1-800-465-8770 for your text messages. 1-800-465-8770. The city of Burien is suing King County. The mayor, Kevin Schilling, joins us in just a few moments.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
As we've been reporting, there's been a lot of drama between the city of Burien and Dow Constantine's King County Sheriff's Office. They sued to stop an ordinance from going into effect, an ordinance that would stop the proliferation of homeless encampments all around the city. Unfortunately, the sheriff's office didn't want to do its job, and now it's sort of forced the city of Burien to sue. They're suing the King County Sheriff's Office, or suing the county. Joining me on the line to discuss is the mayor of Burien, Kevin Schilling. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back on, Jason.
What are the basics in this lawsuit?
Well, it looks like the basics in this lawsuit are that the city of Burien is claiming, and I think rightfully claiming, that the King County Sheriff's Office has violated our interlocal agreement. And this comes after we've tried to set up meetings with the sheriff's office and meetings with the county and their lawsuit against us to settle the constitutional question in the U.S. Federal District Court. This is a lawsuit in County Superior Court to determine whether or not they have violated their ILA with us by not going through the proper process that's laid out in the ILA to determine the dispute, and by unilaterally deciding not to enforce a lawfully established ordinance in the city.
Without getting too in the weeds, what is the normal process if they have a concern over the constitutionality of an ordinance?
Well, within our ILA, not getting too into the weeds, but important for everybody who's listening to know, especially if someone's city contracts with another government, those contracts will say we expect you to go through XYZ process. So our process is with the King County Sheriff's Office Oversight Committee, where they would bring something to them, and then the Oversight Committee would work together with all the other agencies, organizations, cities who are members to determine if something has been violated or not. So that never happened with the sheriff to us. However, our city manager did go to the KCSO oversight committee to ask them to weigh in on the sheriff's lawsuit to us. So they never did it to us, but we did it in response to their lawsuit. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything within the agreement that says the sheriff can tell deputies not to enforce, but then completely ignore you guys until it's broadcast and published?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why this lawsuit's been filed in Superior Court, because we're wanting to make sure that there's some judicial decision that says that is in violation or not in violation, but we want to be able to have the judiciary say for certain that it is or is not.
Now, you filed this in Snohomish County Court?
Correct.
Explain that.
I think the reasoning behind that is that we want, you know, a neutral arbiter there. We want to be able to have a judge rule on this that hasn't been seeing all the ins and outs, nitty gritty of the news, might not have, you know, no relationships in King County. We want a neutral, objective observer.
And you can do that for a case that comes out of King County and between a city in King County and an agency?
I'm assuming so. I'm assuming so. That was obviously at the discretion of our city attorney and outside counsel. So I'm going to say according to their filing, yes.
So ultimately, let's say the court side with you. What then is the expectation that the sheriff will actually enforce, or is that the means that you would be able to take as a city of Burien to end the contract?
Well, that's what's interesting about this, Jason, is like, and I've gotten this question a couple times from people, like, what's the next step? What happens after this? And, you know, I think there's two viable situations here. The first is our courts, whether it's the U.S. Federal District Court saying it is constitutional or the Superior Court saying they did violate the ILA, you know, I think one ultimate future outcome here is that the sheriff's office just reverts back to enforcing the ordinance that they were enforcing already.
Mm-hmm.
But my problem with that is, well, then what? We just act like all this experience hasn't happened, and we just go back to normal.
Well, I mean, do you trust the King County Sheriff's Office?
Well, here's the issue. Here is that it's not just about me; it's about the people of Burien, and it's about voters in Burien. And I think there's been a serious distrust overall in the relationship between our city and King County, no doubt about it, because they haven't been enforcing this rule, and we've all seen now that King County can just go and say, no, we're not going to do that. And I think that the natural next step to any of this is figuring out how Burien as a community can be independent and autonomous as much as possible, while still maintaining some element of partnership. But that's the tough part about this, Jason. I mean, we've been sued. You know? Yeah. That's the relationship breaker. So I think that no matter what the sort of imagined future here is, something along the lines of a change to the ILA at minimum, and at maximum, an independent police force.
And how much are you paying the King County Sheriff's Office?
Altogether, I think yearly we pay them $16 million.
Okay, so it's a nice little chunk of change for the city of Burien, right? I mean, the size of a city like this, that's a lot of money.
And it makes up 45% of our budget. And the timeline of this actually, and as I've said to you and others before, we're working on a public safety levy. We're working on asking voters if they'd like to increase their taxes to cover whatever gap might exist between the amount of money we pay right now and what we would need to pay in order to have an independent police force.
Yeah.
So that would be a decision for voters to decide. And I think that based off this experience of the last couple months, people are ready and willing to see the city of Burien have more independent say on what laws they pass and what laws are enforced.
Other than it just being awkward, what's the relationship like at this point? How's the communication going?
You know, the relationship is fine. The problem is, Jason, I see this is the biggest issue. The folks this hurts the most are not just the people who really respect and care about the police in Burien, which is the majority of Burien voters. Like, mm-hmm. Burien has a universally high approval rating of our police force because we have really innovative stuff going on with our co-responder model. We have a downtown police officer that goes in like a kind of old school, like downtown and like walks around the core. But this actually, what's been going on is it hurts the rank and file of the police force the most, right? Like it's a little awkward when I talk to them, but I come back to the point where I get to them and I say, we all want the same thing. We all want a safe community. We all want laws to be enforced, and we all want to make the public spaces accessible and free for everybody.
Yeah.
And I think when we got to remember that we share those common goals as community members and law enforcement officers. But it is a bit awkward right now. But certainly, you know, I think what the majority of people have seen this as, it has been a waste of taxpayer and government time and money.
Yeah, no
whole
kidding.
Whole argument has been ridiculous.
Well, and the irony of it all is that the Supreme Court in just a few months could end up saying the whole idea that you do, in fact, have to offer someone shelter in order to clear an encampment is bunk. Like, this is a case that is currently in front of the Supreme Court, and they will hear it. And it, even though it comes from Grants Pass, Oregon, this is really based on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling from Idaho several years ago that said you have to offer some other shelter space before you even clear. So the whole idea of the legal claim coming from, or concern, I guess, coming from Sheriff Patty Cole Tindall and Dow Constantine might be completely moot in a very short time period.
Right. The timeline on this is very strange because the April 5th hearing for us is only happening 2 weeks before the U.S. Supreme Court hears the Ninth Circuit appeal. And then do people think that this U.S. Supreme Court is what do people think this U.S. Supreme Court's going to do? You know, I mean, I think it would be wild if this U.S. Supreme Court says every single city in the United States cannot create any form of law that tackles tent encampments in their community. The U.S. Yeah. Supreme Court, I would be shocked if they do that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would be shocked. So we wish you the absolute best of luck. This is absurd the way, even if they had concerns that were reasonable, and sure, they could have concerns that are reasonable. You could pass an ordinance that says no one can speak ever again in the city of Burien. It's total silence. And of course, you're not going to do that, but they could come forward and say, this is unconstitutional. We're going to make sure that we have at least a conversation before we move forward with any kind of legal action. They chose not to do that. In fact, they chose to keep this a secret from the city leaders. It's absurd. And it tells you everything you need to know about how King County Executive Dow Constantine does business. The good part about this is, of course, he's not running for re-election. He'll make that announcement in the coming weeks. So at least, you know, depending on your political future, how long you plan to be mayor and be put in that position, you might not have to deal with him again for in a few months.
I'll just end with this, Jason, because I think ultimately we all know this conversation and this issue is about the people who are on the street, who are needing shelter and services. Yep. And I'll say this, since the time the King County Sheriff and the county executive have determined that they're not enforcing our tent regulation, we have had three overdoses and one death of mm-hmm. those overdoses. And that's just been in a matter of a week and a half.
Yeah.
When we know that there is shelter and we know that there are services out there, and the city of Burien was and wanting always to get people off the street and into shelter and services, not regulating the tent encampments have led to three overdoses and one death.
Yeah. And they don't really seem to care, it doesn't seem like. But hey, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. They think what they're doing is the right thing. I pretend at least to give them the benefit of the doubt. We've been talking with the mayor of Burien, Kevin Schilling. Thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jason.
Absolutely. You're listening to the Jason Rand Show. When we come back, we're going to dive into some quick hits.
The Jason Rand Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
So the talk show host who did the interview with Karine Jean-Pierre, who ended up getting her so upset that she hangs up on him, he's been making some of the rounds because... You know, there have been some accusations being thrown about, which include the fact that folks say that he added to the end of the call, he added in a dial tone. Okay. This is how it sounded when Karine Jean-Pierre, offended that the host Mark Garrison of WBT in Charlotte, asked whether or not Joe Biden has dementia.
Does the president have dementia?
That is a credibly offensive question to ask.
How does Mr. Biden win votes when people don't have as much disposable income?
All the important groceries, those costs have gone down because of what this president has been able to do. And with that, thank you so much, Mark. Have an amazing, amazing day.
Wow. Wow.
Wow. So a few things. And I cannot believe I'm going to do this. With the more context I've gotten out of this interview, does not make it seem like she hung up in the traditional sense. I can tell you, having done interviews like this, it doesn't sound like the audio was altered at the end there, because their phone systems, when you're on certain phone systems, it does automatically give you that kind of dial tone at the end when they hang up. That's just so I've been on systems like that. Usually when we're, you know, talking to someone who's within a telephone infrastructure that has multiple lines that is being used to dial out, maybe someone else was the one who made the call and then they connected. That part makes total sense to me. But also, when you're talking to people like Karine Jean-Pierre, you often are being given an allotment of time, 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 8 minutes, whatever it is. And all of us who get in that position, we always, always, always try to go over. We try to sneak in one final question and put them in a position where they have to answer and then talk a little bit longer. And I have been in interviews where they've said, I have to go. I really do appreciate it. And they kind of rush you off. Now, I don't recall being in an interview with, actually one exception. I was in an interview with someone who, it was a musician, George Ezra. And they gave us 10 minutes. And right at 10 minutes, the publicist got on the phone and said, okay, thank you. We're gone. And then hung up. But other than that, they'll usually say something like, I have to go, and then they'll allow you to say goodbye, and then you both part ways. listening in that clip with that context makes it sound like we're maybe dealing with that and not necessarily someone who angrily hung up. Now, she was clearly upset when the question of dementia came up. There's no doubt about that. Zero doubt about that. But let's hear how he was on Fox News, how he got this interview to begin with.
She had an availability on Tuesday morning, would like to talk about the president's visit here in North Carolina, and would I be interested in talking to her? And I said, sure.
That, I guarantee you that this was one of those, we'll give you about 10 minutes. Because she didn't set up this interview herself. It was set up on behalf of her office from the greater comms department. And again, they're not always that specific in 10 minutes. Sometimes they just say, oh, about how long do you think you need or about how long do you want? And they'll work with you. But sometimes they very clearly do have 10-minute slots or again, whatever the number is. And again, this now makes it seem more and more like that was actually the case. Because again, we've personally experienced this, and I can't remember what it was for. It was, we had for some reason Tim Scott on and Rick Scott. I can't remember what the reason was, but they were offered to us to promote something. I don't remember what it was. And it wasn't related to them. It was related to something political. Maybe you guys recall because it was not that long ago. But for those calls, they just say, hey, about how much time do you need? I said, give us about 10 to 12 minutes. We should be good. And I think for the most part, we were 10 to 12 minutes. We maybe went over a little bit, but they know not to do back to back to back to back. When you're on one of these calls, when they're set up the way that this one sounds like it, they're on back to back to back to back to back. You just get it all done, rip the Band-Aid off.
Oh, there's no question in my mind. She hung up. Look, I've done lots of these kinds of interviews before where people are on a tight schedule. And when you begin to run out of time, they simply say, oh, look, I'm sorry, I've got to go. I hope you have a nice day. And usually there's a quick goodbye. Thank you very much. There was none of that. It was like, have a wonderful day. Click.
Okay. 86% of people in the ABC poll that we just had about 4 weeks ago said that they think the president is too old to run for re-election. And then it's around 65% of people. People say that they think he doesn't have the mental acuity in order to be president again. So I don't think the question is out of bounds. Are you surprised that they don't have a better answer?
And, you know, she should have had a better answer, of course. She 100% should have had a better answer. And yet she didn't. And she has to have known that this was going to come up. You know, Dana is obviously, you don't even have to look at any poll to know that people are talking about this. And certainly, you know, Karine Jean-Pierre knows that Republicans are talking about this, and that makes it an issue in a swing state. That's just how it works. That's just how it works. So this was just, here's a funny thing. Here's a funny thing. And I made this point last night on Fox News. This whole interview is now getting attention it otherwise would not have received had she just answered the question in a slightly different way. And as I've said, I don't think his question was phrased appropriately if he wanted to get a real answer. I think there are ways to ask the same question without asking it so direct, and you essentially would fool Karine Jean-Pierre into answering it in a way that actually gives you maybe some substance. But because of how this all ended and because of the way that she abruptly ended the call, even if it was a legitimate reason because they were going a little bit too over, she ended up bringing more attention to this very issue than she otherwise would have had she just answered the question in a reasonable way without any emotion, without any of this, oh, I'm so offended kind of, tone. That's the funny part here. That's the funny part. And, you know, Mark Garrison is, of course, going to lean into this. He should. I would if I were him. Make it an even bigger deal. I find myself, and maybe I'm spoiled. I'm spoiled here because I know how radio works and I know how these interviews work. But this doesn't seem like that big of a story to me. It just doesn't. Am I not supposed to say that? I mean, if you want to press me, I guess I'll take it back. It's such a huge deal. This doesn't seem like that big of a deal to me. The funny part is that she made it into a big deal unnecessarily. And perhaps that's really what we should be talking about. She's the one who screwed up here. She made this into a story that it should not have been made into. Because there are a lot of other pressing issues. In fact, one of the pressing issues, and people are now starting to pay a little bit more attention, is the fact that we are not far away from the whole banning of the sales of EVs. And it's not just Washington State. There are 9 states in total. All of this is a result of a California decision, because all of us are, and I said 2025, 2035. Like, we're not that far away when you think about in the context of the kind of monumental shift you would need to make in order to get to the EV-only lifestyle that they want. 10 years might as well be 10 days. Like, people just don't change that quickly, as much as they want you to think that they will, especially when we're talking about making investments to the tune of, you know, $50,000 on average for an EV. That's insane. Now, I don't know why all of a sudden it's getting a little bit more coverage, other than maybe people just realize, oh, we're not doing so hot in this transition. And for all I know, and perhaps this is the case, you've got studies that suggest, hey, in order to make this kind of thing actually work, in order to get the technology to be fully adopted, you need to give the average consumer, you know, 14 years or something. I don't know, but I've just been seeing a lot of these stories lately, and I would much rather talk about that than I would about Mark Garrison, especially because it's Mark Garrison and not Jason Rantz. And if it was my show, all I would want to do is talk about it. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show.